I received, some of you will recall, an email message asking that I tackle a few questions that were bothering a young man, and he has written to me since. He's reading one of the books that I recommended, but he said essentially, I went to Camp Arrowwood the first session, had a great time at camp and meeting you, but I do know you're a Christian, and I have trouble believing in the Bible and the God of the Bible, as in He created all things. And skipping on down, he says, so my main questions are, why do you believe in the Christian God? Secondly, what do you believe about the Christian God? And thirdly, do you question the Bible? Now, we've started to wade into those questions, but this morning, I want to continue that, and we're going to start out in the Old Testament, in 2 Kings chapter 6, an historical account that tells of a miracle. And we need to understand this perspective if we're going to understand this whole larger subject that we're talking about. In 2 Kings chapter 6, the king of Aram was at war with Israel, starting in verse 8. And what happens is he has a real problem with military intelligence. Every time he's about to go do something, the king of Israel knows what's going on. And they come around the other way, and they're always able to counter the attacks of the king of Aram. And the king of Aram says, we've got to have a spy among us. It says in verse 11, this enraged the king of Aram. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel? And so they answered, none of us, verse 12. None of us, my lord the king, said one of his officers, but Elisha the prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. Go and find out where he is, the king ordered, so I can send men and capture him. Now, excuse me, I just have to pause here. How stupid is this? See, we keep running into this. When people set themselves up against God, they are behaving stupidly. If the problem you're having is there's somebody on the other side who's able to figure out your every move, he knows all your secrets, he knows what you're about to do before you do it, how are you going to capture him? If he's able to report to the king of Israel the very words you speak in the most private part of your house, your bedroom, how are you going to now hatch a plan to go capture him? I mean, this is classic dumb thinking by people who can't simply bow to God and say, okay, I'm up against somebody who is the ruler of the universe and it is stupid for me to fight. But that's humanity. Okay? God creates everything, including us, puts us in paradise, says you can eat any of this fruit except this fruit from that tree right there. What do? We eat the fruit from that tree right there. A wise old person told me years and years ago, if you ever want to see a child put beans up his nose, tell him not to and leave the room. Because one of two things will happen. Either he'll put beans up his nose or he'll suggest the other child try it. Okay? I mean, that's just human nature. That's the way we're wired. And so here, the king of Aram says, we're going to capture him. Go find out where he is so I can send men and capture him. The report came back, he's in Dothan. So that's not Dothan, Alabama. It's a place over there that Dothan, Alabama was named for. Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there, and they went by night and surrounded the city. They went by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my Lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire. all around Elisha. Now, folks, that's just a little vignette, just a little tiny piece of this story. But that is the part that is crucial to what we're going to be talking about today as far as why we believe what we believe. Open his eyes so that he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. What happened? Did the horses and chariots of fire suddenly show up? No, suddenly the servant was allowed to see them. Suddenly he could see what had been there all along. The prophet said to his servant, "Don't be afraid. Those that are with us are more numerous than those who are with them." The enemy that came in to attack the prophet was already outnumbered, but they couldn't see what was going on. Because there is an invisible realm, there are realities that you and I don't see. For many, many years, people didn't know about germs. They didn't. Magnification had not reached the point where you could see microbes, tiny little living things that multiply rapidly, and many of them have the potential to make you ill. As a result, folks who were living in Europe with the benefit of hospitals nearby often went for treatment and ended up worse than the people who were too poor and lived out in the rural areas. There was a doctor, Semmelweis. He is the father of modern antisepsis. That is to say, he's the guy who taught the rest of Western civilization that doctors ought to wash their hands. Dr. Semmelweis didn't know about microbes. He didn't know about germs. But what he noticed one day as he was working in the hospital, he knew that for some reason the women who came to the hospital to have babies died at a much higher rate than the women who stayed home to have babies. And the initial theory among the medical community and within the social network was that the reason that happens is because the women who come to the hospital are generally more affluent, and therefore they're not as hard workers, and therefore they're not as strong and vigorous, and that's why they tend to die at a higher rate. But Semmelweis somehow got the idea that maybe it had something to do with the fact that the medical students were in studying anatomy on cadavers, working on the bodies of people who had died. And that they would be in working on a dead body from somebody who died of who knows what, learning all they could about how the body is put together and how the arteries connect and all this. And then someone would call and say, "Mrs. Peridot is about to deliver." And the doctors would hurry into her room, and with unwashed hands, having just worked on a dead body, they would assist that woman. She would end up getting an infection. She would die. Now, they didn't know about germs. But Semmelweis thought, I wonder if somehow the death of this person and what caused their death is being transferred by the doctors to these women who are coming here to have their babies. And so he required all of his staff to start washing their hands. And guess what happened to the death rate? Plunged. Now, women who came to his hospital were less likely to die than women who stayed out in the country and had their babies at home. The hospital became a place of safety. Guess what the medical community in Europe did to Semmelweis? They mocked him, vilified him, and chased him out of the medical profession, and he died penniless. And the hospital went back to not washing hands. And the death rate went back up. And it wasn't until much later that they actually began seeing germs and had to rethink their position. Now you say, why would people be so stupid? Because they didn't like the implications of what Semmelweis was saying. What Semmelweis was saying is, we have been responsible for these deaths. And the medical community did not want to face that truth. And so rather than face the truth, they went back to business as usual. And the carnage continued in the hospitals. There are things we cannot see that are real nevertheless. And if we recognize the truth of what is not seen, not readily apparent, it would cause us to recognize our own guilt, and it would cause us to have to change our behaviors. And that is something people will resist over and over and over again. Many years ago, I heard, when I was a teenager, some of you, I heard a man named Dr. J. Edwin Orr. He was about this tall, and he had written a stack of books about this tall. And he had, I don't know, three or four PhDs from places like, I don't know, Oxford, Berkeley, NYU, whatever, you know. I mean, pretty good schools. And he said something that has stuck with me. I think it's important. You don't want to take it to the wrong extreme, but I want you to think about this concept. It's very, very important. He said, if you come into my home and we're talking and the kettle on the stove begins to whistle, and you say to me, why is the kettle whistling? And I say, well, I don't know if you've noticed or not, but there are wires out in front of the house that run up and down the street. Those carry electric current. Electricity that's been generated miles from here travels along those wires, and some of that current is brought in through a wire to our home. It goes through circuit breakers on the outside of the house, and it is allowed to pass through a wire under the floor and into the wall socket, where we plug another wire from the stove into it. That current traveling through that network of wires and circuits comes up into the top of the range. And there, when we turn the knob to allow the electricity to pass through that circuit, it goes into a coil of metal that has been specifically designed to create resistance. And the resistance created causes heat to be generated. And that heat from the resistance of the energy going through the coil is transferred through the copper bottom of that kettle. And copper is a very good medium for transferring the heat, okay? And it goes up into the kettle. And there, the water molecules become excited. And as they become more and more excited, what's called Brownian motion develops within the water. It begins to move, those molecules, moving in currents. And they become more and more excited until soon some of those molecules of water are changed from a liquid state to a gaseous state. And of course, the gaseous state requires more space. And so as it's emitted up into the upper part, the upper chamber of the kettle, it begins to build up pressure. And that pressure eventually results in an eruption of steam through the opening of the kettle, which has been designed specifically by the manufacturer to split a column of air so that we hear a whistling sound. And that is why the kettle is whistling. He said, now that's true. That's all true. Maybe boring, but it's true. But he said, you could ask the very same question. Why is the kettle whistling? And my wife would give you what might prove a much more satisfactory answer. She would say, "Because we're about to make tea, would you like some?" All right. Now, who told the truth? Both Dr. and Mrs. Orr. But one of them explained a series of mechanisms describing what was going on, but not answering at all the question of why. The other explained why, not in terms of mechanism and process, but in terms of purpose and design. The kettle is whistling because we're making tea. The Bible does not focus on the issue of process and mechanism. The Bible focuses on the answer to the question of purpose. Why am I here? What is the meaning of life? Now, you can take that illustration in a direction that it should not go, and that is to suggest that whatever the scientists are saying is true, and whatever the theologians are saying is true, they just are talking about two different things. That would be the wrong extreme. One of the reasons I don't believe that everything the scientists tell us is true is because they can't agree on their story. Okay? They can't say, this is the way it is. They debate each other and develop the theme. So I don't have to accept whatever science is currently saying is the way it is. You heard about the woman who was sitting in the room where the scientist was talking about how many billions of years it would be before the sun died, our sun died. And she let out a scream. And he looked to the back and he said, "Madam, are you all right?" And she said, "What did you say?" And he said, "Well, I said that in the sun is going to die in so many billion years." She said, Oh, I thought you said million. Okay. Now, of course, she's not going to be around in 1,000 years. But it was very important to her that it be billions, not millions, before the sun goes out. I guess because she's worried about her grandchildren. No, it's because she's worried about her calculation. She didn't want to be that far off. And yet scientists in the last 5 years have on a number of occasions revised dating of various things and distance and so forth by as much as 50%. Okay? Well, when you're having to revise your numbers by as much as 50%, your numbers are not exactly solid. All right? So I don't accept whatever scientists say as just being the way it is. I know it's changing. There's some very impressive things. There's some very interesting things. But they're still working it out. All right? So that's not my orthodoxy. I don't get all worked up about it. If they say this or if they say that, well, interesting. That's what they're saying currently, huh? But what about what the theologians are saying? Doesn't it change? Yes. Yes, it does. Don't they get together and argue with each other and disagree and so forth? Yes. Yes, they do. So you really can't go by whatever the theologians are saying either, can you? No, you can't. You'd do just as well to listen to the scientists. However, let me tell you what doesn't change. God's Word. God's Word does not change, has never changed, always the same. Heaven and earth are going to disappear. God's Word abides forever. So you can't stake your life and your future and your security on what the scientists say, and you can't stake your life on what the theologians say, but you can stake your life on what God says. Because God is trustworthy. He doesn't make mistakes. You can count on Him. So the question is whether or not you are blessed to see what many people don't see and to believe what a lot of people don't want to believe. So I come to my third illustration. When I was in college, I was asked to teach a Sunday school class that was populated by unruly middle schoolers. It was an affluent community on the North Shore of Boston, Hamilton, Massachusetts, Christ Episcopal Church. And I mean to tell you, these kids were brats. They were punks. They were obnoxious. And they had run off teacher after teacher. Elizabeth Elliot's son-in-law, Walt Shepherd, asked me if I would please try and tackle this class. I said, sure, I'm happy to try. I'd worked with juvenile delinquents as a volunteer in North Carolina, and so having had experience with people who were guilty of robbing and killing and that sort of thing, I was willing to tackle a group of affluent middle schoolers on the North Shore. So he said, all right, I'll be there to introduce you Sunday morning. I said, no, I don't want you to do that. Now, I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but God was speaking to me about what I should do, and I was trying to listen and be obedient. I said, what time do the kids show up, and what time is class supposed to start? They told me. I was there early, before any of the kids showed up. I was there in the room, sitting in a chair across from the door on the far side of the room, just sitting there. And when the first child came in to class, I was asked about how many kids would be there, about how many boys, how many girls, that kind of thing. When the first boy came walking in, he looked at me and I looked at him. I just looked at him. Now, this made him a little nervous for some reason. Because even when you pass a stranger, in our culture, it's ordinary to say, well, good morning. How you doing? Good to see you. Hey. I mean, night before last, I'm in Chicago in a hotel. I'm walking down the hall. I'm walking rather quickly. The other guy's walking rather quickly the other way. But he said to me as he walked past, how you doing? And I thought, what would that man do if I stopped and answered? I said, oh man, I'm so glad you asked. I'm really having a hard time. I mean, he would have run. Right? I mean, we ask questions like that, not at all because we're serious about it, but you speak to people. So what does a kid expect when he comes to Sunday school? He expects the adult in the room to say, good morning, I'm Mr. Jim. Okay? I mean, that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to act like goobers. Okay? And you know, and that's supposed to put kids at ease. And somehow, in a creepy kind of way, I guess it does. But I just sat there and looked at this kid, totally straight-faced. Well, this made him nervous, visibly nervous. And he went over and sat down in one of the chairs and kind of looked around, and there was nobody else there. It was just the two of us. And I just sat there. Well, he didn't say anything to me, and I didn't say anything to him. A few minutes later, another kid came walking in, sees me. I positioned myself so that I was the first person they saw. He sees me. He sees the other kid. He hears no conversation. There's nothing written on the board. This is an uncomfortable scene. He can feel the tension. He doesn't say a word to me. He doesn't say a word to the other kid. He just takes his seat quietly. And I just sat there and looked at him. Well, now this is getting more tense, okay? Another kid comes in, same thing. We did this over and over until I felt that we had as many kids as we were likely to get. They're all sitting in the room being absolutely quiet and just looking at me, kind of looking at each other. They're nervous. They don't know if this is somebody from Friday the 13th or what, okay? I mean, they're just not sure what's going on. By the way, I've never seen that movie, but I have seen the ads. They know that this is weird. This is different. I got up, I walked across, I closed the door, and I turned to them and I said, who am I? They said, what? I said, who am I? We don't know. I mean, it's like, did you eat my teacher? I mean, I don't know who you are. I said, well, who do you think I am? Are you the teacher? I put up on the board, teacher, question mark. So what else? What do you know about me? Okay, weird. What else do you know about me?
You're a man?
Man. What else? We started going through. I asked him, how old am I?
About 30?
30, question mark. What's my name?
We don't know.
I said, well, what do you think my name is?
How would we know?
I said, what are you going to call me?
Bob?
Bob. Any other suggestions? Okay, so we went through and I elicited from them and recorded for them their answers. And I said, now here's the thing. If you want to call me Bill and you want to call me Bob, one opinion is as good as the other. If you want to call me Nancy, that's not a good opinion. Okay? We've already established I'm a man. But you don't know how old I am. Where am I from?
Don't know.
Where do you think I'm from?
Don't know.
So we went through and established some of the stuff they knew, some of the stuff they were guessing, and some of the stuff they were deciding, like what to call me. And then I said, all right, what if I were to tell you that my name is Jim? What if I were to tell you that I am 19 years old and that I'm from North Carolina?
Well, you don't have a southern accent.
He said, does that mean I'm not from North Carolina? How do you know? So we went through and I told them things about myself that were true. Everything I told them about me was true. But they had to decide whether or not they believed it. Well, after I had shared the kind of thing that normally might have been shared at the start of class, and they were making up their minds whether or not they believed it, I said, what if we were to introduce some evidence? And I pulled out my driver's license and passed it around, and they looked and they saw my age and my picture and my name and that I was from North Carolina. And I said, now, how many of you believe that my name is Jim? How many of you believe that I'm 19 years old? How many of you believe that I am from North Carolina? Okay, so now you have chosen to believe the revelation of who I am. You can't know me unless I reveal myself to you. You can know some stuff about me. You can know that I exist. You know I'm not an illusion. You know I'm really here. You know that I'm a man. But you don't know whether I'm single or married. You don't know whether I am this age or this age. You don't know. You have to decide whether or not you believe this, this, or this. And the more I reveal of myself to you, and the more evidence I provide, the stronger the case becomes for believing the revelation that I've given you concerning me. Now you believe this. Yes, we believe. I said, how do you know it's not a fake ID? Why would you do that and shatter their faith? Because they would have thought of it after they got home. They were bright kids. I said, not only does there have to be revelation for us to have relationship, there has to be self-disclosure, but there has to be evidence in order to establish trust. Okay? There has to be evidence, self-disclosure, revelation, evidence in order to establish trust. But then there also has to be faith. You have to decide if you believe or not, in order to know somebody. You have to decide whether or not you believe in order to know somebody. You can't know somebody if you're not willing to make up your mind. If I say, my name is Jim, and it's like, well, I'm not so sure about that. Well, our relationship's not going to go very far. You understand? Now, God is the author and perfecter of our faith. Jesus is the author and perfecter of our faith. But I want you to understand when my young email friend wants to say, you know, the Bible isn't enough. Well, the Bible points to things outside the Bible as evidence of who God is and the fact that there is a God. But if you want to really know God, you've got to get to know Him through His chosen means of revelation, all of which points to the person of Jesus Christ. And unless you are willing to trust Jesus, you're never really going to know God. You're not going to know Him. You can know stuff about Him, you can believe stuff about Him, but you won't know Him in a relational way. Is that clear? So my charge to you is, first of all, to realize that just because you can't see something doesn't mean it's not real. You see the evidence. God has revealed himself through creation, through our conscience, ultimately through Jesus Christ, in the scriptures, in history, and in our lives today. I don't wonder from time to time if my wife exists. I know her. We have a relationship. And if somebody tried to convince me that there is no Susan, that, you know, I wouldn't have said, oh, maybe I've just been going on blind faith all these years. No, I know her. We have a relationship, okay? We slept in the same bed last night, okay? We know each other. We know each other. And when it comes to believing the Bible about God, as you begin to believe what the Bible says about God, and you discover the reality of the presence of the risen Christ and the miraculous answers to prayer that God is still doing today, then when the doubts attack, you don't get shaken up. Because you know, not just about God, you know God. That is my prayer for each of you, that you would know him, really know him.